and welcome to Future Library. It's part of the never-ending recordings of the podcast. Listeners, I'm now so far ahead with this. This one could possibly be coming out in 2015. Who knows? I'm hoping sooner than that, though. My guest today, he is somebody who should, if there was any justice in the world, be massively famous. He's opinionated, he's funny, he's smart, and he, most importantly, well, actually, no, that sounds terrible, not most importantly, in addition to those things, makes very, very good music. Let me welcome Lyle Christine. Lyle, how are you doing?
Alex, hello. That was what a lovely introduction.
Well,
thank you for that. That was a very nice introduction. Hi, Alex. It's great to be here.
I should tell listeners a little bit about you, Lyle. Actually, no. In the tradition of the show, and the listeners know this now. They know that I do this. And actually, the thing is, listeners, there's a kind of another look behind the curtain. I've actually got in front of me a piece of a screen thing that Lyle actually made with some pictures of Beats on it. He sent me yesterday to give a little bit of information. Now, I could be sound really cool and read from that, which is the first time I'll ever do that, or I could actually hand over to Lyle and ask him to explain about himself. And I think it's better for Lyle to do it himself. So, Lyle!
Well, is it, Alex, better for me? Okay.
Tell us about yourself, and then if you want me, then I can hop in and tell you a bit about yourself as well, and we'll go back and forth.
It's very difficult to say anything about myself because this is supposed to be talking about music, I suppose. So I want to talk. How do I sum up the music side of my life in a nice warm introduction about myself? I still fiercely hate the music industry. I still haven't actually come to a conclusion why I remain somebody who makes music or somebody who takes quite strong views of the music industry. But for anybody who doesn't know me, I make music. I've made a few solo albums. I've come through the kind of usual background of playing in a band up in Scotland, done the kind of bar basement gigging circuit and all that kind of stuff. Not a great experience. I'm now at quite a good plateau, quite a happy place of just in charge of my own stuff, recording my own stuff, writing my own stuff, producing it, the whole lot. That's a happy place to be. I think when Alex talks about opinionated, it's, I've got big problems with the music industry and big problems with, I would say, you know, the last 10 years, take a decade from the year 2000, it's been a pretty heartbreaking time in a lot of respects with contributions to culture. And I mean, that's not really an introduction. It's more, you should have talked about the Beats.
Well, I gave you the visual
cues and then you do this to me, Alex.
For everybody's sake, I'll do a little professional sounding introduction just to give a bit of background on my guest, Lyle.
Is there a background? I don't think there's. This is probably
a background.
Okay.
Well,
okay.
I'll do this in my best. I'll try my best radio voice for this.
Okay.
Which is again another treat for the listeners. Let's see. So, Lyle Christine is a musician who's currently living in Glasgow with his lovely girlfriend Katriona.
Katrina.
You see, I've fucked it up already. he's researching recovery from gambling addiction at the University of Glasgow, and he's working on a new album at the moment. His background, he came up, and the way I know him, is that he came up through the Dundee music scene between 2004 and 2007, when he was in a member of a band called Stigma. He went back to Fife for a short while in the middle of the noughties, and then went to Glasgow where he has remained. Stigma were a three-piece rock band who, whilst not... that didn't go well. whilst not setting the world alight, did give rise to the talent that is Lyle Christine and introduced his online persona to a wider audience. How was that?
That was good. That was good.
Apart from
that,
the
was good.
In the middle.
That's more like it. I particularly enjoyed the cough. That's the kind of thing we're looking for.
That's it. And you know, and as listeners know, I don't edit anything out, so that will stay in.
Grand.
Excellent. And hopefully people will be listening to it, and maybe somebody listening to it in their headphones right now will suddenly cough themselves because they'll be coughing and they go, oh no, I need to cough now. But I better stop talking about coughing because I'm going to need to cough again.
Okay.
So yeah, you were in Stigma. who...
No, we're not going to talk about that. Are we going to talk about that?
We could talk about it briefly.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, yeah. I used to be in a band, a three-piece band. And that gave me a pretty good introduction. I'd say more in the live perspective, because that's been on hold for a long time for reasons that are I think you'll agree, are kind of obvious why people kind of get turned off by playing live, especially when you have to deal with certain promoters in Scotland. And we can get into that in a second, but that gave me an introduction to that. Musically, really not particularly great stuff going on there. It's, it didn't really have enough time to develop, and as it turns out, we weren't getting along very well with it. And anyway, that was an introduction to something. So basically, what I did, instead of trying to get another band together, I thought, it's best just to do this by myself, because I was desperately trying to find some enjoyment in music again, because I think I had lost the kind of fun aspect. I mean, it's a lot of hard work, and it's a challenge playing in a band, but there's got to be an element of fun in it as well, regardless of what your goals are, no matter how small or big, you know, your achievements that, you know, you want to hopefully attain. I'd lost that at that point, basically. But I thought, if I maybe at least try this where everything's under my control, it sounds very kind of megalomaniacal, but then hopefully I can kind of, you know, find the pleasure in it again, which I did. And that's what I was trying to say in the introduction. I feel in quite a good place. And one of the interesting things, I think I've heard a couple of times on previous episodes of this podcast, is people say it takes something like that. It might be the breakup of a band, or just maybe you just slightly mature. It's when you stop trying to like make it in a band or hit some sort of completely unachievable dreams, when you just kind of like stop caring about that and you just focus primarily on making music, that's where your best stuff actually comes. And I'm fortunate enough to also have the kind of like a good critical perception of understanding with your own stuff, you know, what was useless, what was rubbish, and what's actually quite strong. I dropped a lot of silly ideas, silly dreams and things like that, and it became much more realistic to just go for producing and making music that you personally are happy with, and it's a bonus if everybody else seems to like it. And it's yeah, it's a good place to be.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a theme that's kind of come up regularly, certainly in the last 6 months of the show, is, you know, and as I've talked to people who make music on their own, it seems to be often the case that, you know, they firstly struggled with communicating ideas that they wanted with, you know, the bands they were playing
with.
Often usually because they had a very clear cut idea of what they wanted, and it's almost, yeah, I think it's, I'm trying to work out how to best word it. I think what happens is eventually you reach the point where you think, you know what, screw it. I'm just going to be completely egocentric with this. This is my vision. There's no reason to involve anybody else. I've now got enough skill to do this on my own. Technology has moved on to the point, like we talked about this with Gary Marshall, technology moves on to the point where you don't actually need a drummer. You don't need, you know, this, that and the other. It becomes easier to do. And when it becomes easier to do, it becomes more pleasurable to do. When you're not having to stand in a smelly rehearsal room week after week.
Yeah, see, I mean, that's exactly. Yeah, it's when you look back and you think, you know, there are certain things you do because you think that you should be doing them.
Yeah.
You know, like rehearsing a certain amount of times every month, or playing a certain amount of gigs in a year and that sort of thing, or playing a certain amount, you know, playing in certain venues or being associated with certain bands and all that kind of thing, because it simply is down to naivety. You know, you don't really have any other model to kind of associate with, so that ends up happening. But then it just comes to the point where you think, this isn't actually what I want. It's not making me happy. Why am I putting myself through this? And, you know, when you reach that point, wherever you are, it's got to change. You can't keep kind of like, you know, beating that dead horse sort of thing. Because I've seen it with other bands who do that, and it's tragic. It's absolutely tragic to 10 years later, you happen to be somewhere and you see a band that you once played a show with, and they're still doing that thing, that same set, that same look, that same sound, and they're 10 years older. And it's just like, God, I can't imagine anything more depressing, still doing that sort of thing. And but I think to get a mature perspective of it, especially in Scotland, you need to go through that to understand how limited your opportunities are. Mm-hmm. And you can start off with big dreams, but you need to be realistic about what you want to do and what's going to make you happy. And I went through that, and it's heartbreaking when a band breaks up, or when, especially if you fall out with people, which often happens, clash of personalities. And it's nothing to do with clash of egos. It's just you realize that you don't actually have anything in common with people, except you happen to maybe play in a band with them. That's not a fertile ground for the pursuit of any kind of artistic creativity. It's just going to be heartbreaking at the end of the day. Yeah. So, even speaking about it like this, you find yourself kind of, it sounds cliched. You know, we didn't have, you know, limousines and champagne, but you still end up with this, the bitterness and heartbreak. And, you know, it could be the story of any band, no matter how big or small they became. It's the same road that everybody seems to walk. And I suppose at the end of it, that there is some sort of camaraderie in the kind of, I don't know, hitting that brick wall of reality. That's what I find with a lot of people.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. I think it's, there's the kind of hoops you think you have to jump through through the years. You know, you think, you know, I'm living in this city, so I should play this venue, or I'm this type of band, so I should be working with this type of band, or, you know, I really, you know, you go through the whole thing of saying, oh, well, you know, the way we'll do it is we'll play small gigs with our friends, then we'll try and get some kind of slightly better support with people, and then, you know, then we'll go and record a demo. And
exactly.
Then
we'll, and it's, you think there's a ladder, like a career ladder that you should go through.
Yeah.
And, but to be fair, though, I mean, I do have a kind of fondness, a romantic idea of the stepping stones of, you know, there was a time where it was quite a good idea to try and get yourself on an independent record label. And then you had the opportunity to go to a major label. And there was that kind of, you know, very much more of an American model of how bands used to do it. Say from the late 80s going into the 90s, that was the kind of model. And that's the kind of time that I haven't really, there's part of me that hasn't moved on from that sort of thing, of my kind of romantic idea of what it's all about. And it just doesn't happen anymore. It's just a ridiculous idea. But you're right. Yeah, it's, you know, lots of bands hold that similar idea, and it's not realistic in Britain. And it certainly is now that you've got our beautiful online world. It's completely different. And I don't know what the direction it's to go in. Go ahead.
No, go on.
No, it was just before coming onto this podcast, I was thinking, it'd be good to, you know, if I was trying to give advice to bands who are maybe, say, in their early 20s just now, what advice would I give them? And it's just, I don't know what their perspective is, because it's that generation comes from nothing but pastiche. Because of, you can call them, you know, the internet generation, Generation Y, whatever you want to call it. And I don't think I could offer any advice. I mean, Alex, is one of your sons in a band?
Yeah, my youngest son Cameron plays music and does various things.
Right.
He's very, very talented, to be honest. He's far better guitarist than I am.
Have you given him any advice about, you know, just in general, the business, your experience, or have you kind of like, son, you'll have to make your own mistakes?
I've tried to, but I've tried to do it in a way that isn't kind of saying, don't do this, don't do that. The more useful things I think I've said to him is, he was playing with a band that was kind of doing okay and playing kind of semi-regular, quiet, high-profile gigs, but he's kind of a singer and he plays lead guitar. And they had him as kind of a backing vocalist and rhythm guitarist. And I think he was finding himself a little bit bored with that. But they'd reached a point where they were starting to say, Cameron, your gear's not really good enough. You're going to need to get some better equipment. And I kind of said to him, well, as soon as I heard him say that they were saying that, I kind of thought, well, yeah, I said to him, you know what? If a band's saying that and they're more interested in the equipment you've got than what you bring to it, then do you need them? You know, do you need to be a member of that band?
I think it's a dangerous point. I've been through that. Well, not in like musicians that I've played with, but I've heard other bands start talking about it. It's like when they hit a point where, I don't know, the creativity is maybe kind of, you know, fallen by the wayside, and they start talking about gear a lot and, you know, investing in a lot of equipment and things like that. And it's always a bit of a warning signal to me that, you know, it's really not important. I don't know, maybe they think it is. It's just,
well, I mean, I was trying to explain to him that you can get by with the cheapest and most knackered gear in the world as long as you're doing something useful. And he was like saying, oh, well, I've only got this 30-watt amp. And I'm like, well, to be fair, if it's mic'd up in a venue, that's going to be loud enough. If you're playing a gig in a small pub, you might even be able to get away with that at full volume without having it mic'd up. I mean, at the moment, I've actually kind of lent him my big 100-watt amp that I used to use. Because, you know, I thought at least he'll have that and he's got a bit of kind of oomph to it. And he's got a couple of guitars that I've lent him as well. But it's, yeah, I think it was more cases of, the advice I've given him more recently is don't worry about getting signed. Make music that you like. Don't chase getting signed at all. Put the music up on things like Bandcamp. Make money back that way. Record at home. Don't pay for recording. Always get it done at home. Get people you know to do it.
Yeah.
It's cheap, and he's got one of my old MacBooks as well with Ableton on it and an audio interface and stuff. So he's got access to stuff that I wouldn't have dreamed of having. And in fact, he's actually got my old Roland 8-track that recorded on zip discs as well.
Oh, I had one of those. Didn't we have the same one? Didn't we have a conversation about that? Yeah.
They were fantastic.
Do you reckon zip discs? Mine screwed up all the time.
It started
making this horrible clicking. As soon as it did that, I knew everything I'd recorded on it was useless. I maybe had a bad model or something. I don't know.
See, I did really well. The thing about it is that machine is that for a long time after I'd stopped recording on it, I used it as a mixer for other things and an effects.
Oh, right. Okay. It's
for any listeners who are interested, it's the Roland VS840EX, I think was the model.
Yeah.
Which recorded on 100 meg and 250 meg zip.
That was
discs. And had a tiny little window that you could see a little sort of scrolling pattern of blocks going across.
That was it.
The interface was clunky, to be honest, but I'm guessing you reached the point where you were kind of using that little wheel thing to zip through things really fast and pressing buttons really quick and not even thinking about what you were doing, arming channels and stuff.
I was.
Yeah, I mean, I recorded a lot of the kind of quite complex early VMoth stuff was recorded on it. With the multiple layering of vocals and things, you know, that was, but yeah.
The reason I got that in the first place, I went to the Prince's Trust.
Yeah.
And put forward, I said, you know, I'm a musician starting out and I need something to record with. And they gave me 700 quid for it.
Nice.
That wouldn't happen now.
No.
That would have been back in, that's probably like 2000, you know.
Wow. So you bought a Roland.
That was just a sideline point of probably no interest, but.
Oh no,
just,
this is all interesting.
Yeah, no, so I did, yeah, and it was absolutely amazing at first, don't get me wrong. But looking back at it, what were they thinking of zip discs, for Christ's sake?
I know, that was the biggest media kind of storage you could get at the time.
Yeah.
You know, it was real cutting edge for about 2 minutes. the thing about it as well was that in the manual, which is something I always remembered, was that there was actually a little hole at the back that you could pop out a metal piece, and it showed you how to install a SCSI port.
I don't remember that, really.
Yeah, it had in the manual how to install a SCSI port into the back of it to connect it to your computer. You know, obviously this pre-USB.
Of course.
You know, I'm now sitting at the desk I'm sitting at the moment. In fact, I'm sitting at my dining table because the way out, we've got this Sky broadband. I say broadband in the loosest possible meaning of the word. And usually I record in the upstairs office. But for Skype, for some reason, it doesn't work very well in the upstairs office. So I come down and sit in the dining room. So I'm sitting at the dining table at the moment. And the equipment I've got in front of me probably can do way more than that great big heavy box could. I've got my little kind of Behringer mic. I've got a little Behringer mixer, which has got space for like one XLR to go in and a couple of kind of phono inputs. And I've got my MacBook and the software on that. And that's
so stuff. is your Behringer your, is that's your audio interface?
Yeah, that's what I use for. I got it so that I could plug mics in. Because the new MacBooks didn't have a mic in and a headphone out, they just have one port. I wanted to get a decent USB thing, and my little fast track that I'd had for a few years wasn't really up to the task. So
since pretty good. I've recently got into Ableton.
That's fab.
It is fair. I bought the, have you heard of the Novation Launchpad?
I have heard of it. Have you got one of those as well?
Yeah, it's pretty. It's good fun. But I was thinking about recording my next album on it. Just, I love learning new software and, it's really good fun. Ableton's really good fun. I normally use Cubase. I tried installing Pro Tools, but it completely screwed everything up, so just uninstalled it. I'd like to learn Pro Tools. I'm sure it's not that different from Cubase, but I just like to learn it for the hell of learning it. I don't have any particular snobbishness about which software to use to record, but Ableton just seems like a lot more fun, and some of my songs are, they do have, I'll throw in a bit of a kind of like, you know, beatsy loop kind of track, because I really, really enjoy using drum loops. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, why don't I just record the whole thing on that? So I might do.
Well, the thing about Ableton is that it can be used as a live instrument in the kind of live view.
Yeah.
But in the session view, you can use it as a straightforward multi-tracker.
Mm.
And you can... You know, I think the thing I find that I really like about it is it seems to me to be far easier to just move audio around in it than it is anything else.
You
can just grab it and shift it around.
You're right. It definitely is. And I think that, you know, I probably recommend that to people starting out, for example. Ultimately, these programs, they're not massively different between each other, but some of them are really unstable depending on what kind of, you know, laptop or desktop they're using with them. I mean, Cubase has just always been really unstable. Unless you've got a really powerful system, Pro Tools is always either not going to work or just completely, you know, freeze anything up. What were you using, before you got into Ableton then, what were you using for your music?
Well, I got into Ableton very, very early with
the
laptop stuff. I mean,
When
I first started using the laptop stuff, I had a demo version of Pro Tools that I used for about 6 weeks. And then I think it was actually Peter from Secondhand Marching Band got me a pirated copy of Ableton 1.
Right, okay.
Live One for my old...
Ableton One?
Yeah. That's the first one I ever used, and it was Ableton One, and I ran it on a black Wall Street PowerBook, an Apple Wall Street, which was a G3. It had an 8 GB hard drive, 192 megs of RAM, and it was already about 5 or 6 years old when I bought it.
Yeah, right.
So I got it for, like, £250 secondhand, and it was pre-USB, and it was heavy, and but I started using Ableton on that, and then when I upgraded to my white MacBook in about 2005 probably, at that point I then went up to Live 5, and then recently a chap called Henry Faber, very kindly, because he'd stopped using it, gave me his license for Ableton 8, which is what I'm using. But I've just used Live for a very long time. And I'm always finding new things about it. You know, finding out that I could edit video in it was amazing.
Oh, right. Well, I've learned something as well. I didn't know you could edit video in it.
I think after version 8, you could edit video in it. You just drag a video file into it and go to view or window, and it has video window is one of the options, and you can then start editing video in it. So if I'm chucking something together very quickly for YouTube or something, and I want little bits in it and I want to have audio that I can edit within it, then I'll tend to chuck it together in Ableton. The resolution is not as great as it would be doing it in something else, but you know, if it's just for something really fast, then it's perfect. I mean, one of the things we were talking about just before we started the show was some of the online creationists I deal with in my other existence as a podcaster elsewhere. And the chap Jason Burns has a couple of videos on my YouTube channel of him kind of put through Songify and Rapifier on my iPad.
Oh, right, okay.
turning some of his rants into little songs.
Oh, and that sounds amazing.
And the videos are synced up with him. And I did that by using Ableton. It was a piece of piss. Put the audio in from the song and then just dragged the video files around until it all matched and cut bits and looped them and stuff in it. You know, it's very good for chucking a video together. And the other thing that's actually really great about it is if you put a video file into a piece of music you've got, it will quantize the video to the song.
Oh, right, okay.
So there's a video online I made. It was at the suggestion of Paul McGarrigle's partner. I should say partner, wife now, Christine. And she, actually it's Christina, I think. Yeah, she said at one point when a BBC radio had an advert that had a guy sitting listening to the radio, and there were two versions of it. There was one where he was listening to a football team winning, and he starts to cry at his table out of kind of like, well, I think maybe his team's lost, so he's starting to cry at his table, at his kitchen table. And then there was another version where there was I think it's Pale Blue Eyes by the Velvet Underground was on,
right? Okay.
And he's kind of like crying to that, and it's like saying, you know, BBC radio, there's something for everyone. And Christina said, oh, you know what, you should have him crying to something off that record Lulu by Lou Reed and Metallica. So I thought, right, I'll do that. So I grabbed a part of a track from that album. I just went online, found the first track I found, which like has this kind of ridiculous boom, tsh, boom, and then Lou Reed going, I am a voice of the magnets, and it's like, so I put this on, and I just put the two things together, rendered it, played it, and all the cuts in the video were on the beat. I was like, that's really fucking clever. So, sounds good. Yeah, it's on my YouTube channel. It's a hidden video. It's a private video. So I'll send you a link to it later on. I decided that I'd make it private so it didn't come up if, you know, the BBC were looking for it.
But, were you upset about Lou?
Lou Reed never really kind of impacted me that much.
He was a miserable bastard, wasn't he?
Yeah, I was one of those people that saw the Velvet Underground and thought I wouldn't form a band.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I never saw the Velvet Underground. I'm not that old, listeners, even though some people think I am. No, he was a bit of a curmudgeon, but he did make some really good music. I mean, Metal Machine music's really good. In fact, that's the only Lou Reed album I have, is Metal Machine Music. So it just shows how contrary I am.
I think Transformer is rubbish, just for the record.
Isn't that the one... I'm thinking of Neil Young, who did the album with vocoders.
I know the one you mean.
Is that called Trans?
Yeah, Trans. There you go,
that's why I was getting them mixed up.
I've never heard it.
Is it everything vocoded on it?
Yeah, pretty much. Well, the thing was, his son was born with Down syndrome. I think both his children actually were born with Down syndrome, which is astronomically rare. And I think he was messing about with a vocoder or something like that. And his son was responding to it when he was very small. And I think Neil was like, oh, this is quite an interesting way that I can maybe communicate to my son. And he thought, I'm going to do an album that's got quite a lot of this on it. But at the same time, he was having massive problems with Geffen, I think, just to do with his recording contract obligations. And he just wrote this album that he thought was just going to, you know, it's going to put everyone in a really bad mood at the record company, which it obviously did, because they were like, what the hell is this? Going to record a Neil Young album. So it's just his kind of punky side to him there. But that was quite interesting. But
it's funny. I've gone through kind of love-hate things with vocoders. I kind of hate hearing auto-tune on pop records.
Yes. Because it's disgusting,
so,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's so ubiquitous now, and especially when it's with somebody who can actually sing. Mm. I think it's a real shame when you hear it on somebody who you know can sing anyway, and
it's a horrible sound. It's not, you know, even if you're just using it from the perspective of an interesting application to, you know, an instrument or a voice, it's still I don't find it pleasant to listen to. No, and I'm certainly not against using autotune or any other software to fix things. I'm not against that at all. I just don't think it's used very well. That's the problem.
I mean, what we did, I remember the first time I ever used it was actually in Lipsick. We used it on one track. And
Lipsick, that was a great name for a band.
That was Kirsten that came up with that. That was a fantastic name. My contribution to that was adding the exclamation mark at the end.
Right.
Because it was Lipsick just without it before I joined, and then we decided to add the exclamation mark. But yeah, we had this one track on the last kind of little albumy thing we did, and I was playing around with the vocoder, which was actually built into that Roland thing, which I'd never played around with before. But I plugged in a mic and a keyboard at the same time, and I actually read in the manual how to do it and to make it work, and thought, I've never really made this work before. And I started just talking into the mic and playing the keyboard, and I was kind of this magic coming out the other side of like this tune with me sounding like I was singing in a robot voice. And I quite liked that. But over the years, I've kind of gone more down the route of using it to mangle things together. I tend to not use.
Yeah.
One thing I've kind of found that I quite like is if I've got a track that isn't working very well, I found that maybe adding another thing the same length of it as it over it, and then using one as the input for the carrier and the other one as the input for the tonal content or the dynamics, whatever it is. I can never remember how it works.
Yeah.
And then you get this weird kind of thing comes out the other end that sounds all kind of synthetic and slightly garbled.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that can sometimes kind of, you know, make it interesting. I think misusing it, basically.
Yeah, that's probably the best way to approach it.
Yeah, and using it, you know, maybe running drums through it against a guitar track, or, you know, against a vocal track, or putting your vocals against a guitar track or something in it, you know, where it'll destroy the meaning of both, but will create a kind of third way.
Yeah.
Do you like that?
I like that.
The third way, listeners. So
it's a nice dialectic synthesis you've got going on there.
Well, thank you.
Good. Giddens would be proud.
Thank you very much. I shall take that as a compliment. Yeah. So yeah, I think there's ways to do these things, and I think vocoder can be interesting. So yeah,
how are you settling into your new house, Alex?
It's very nice, I have to say. We're getting there now. Yeah, we've still got a couple of things in boxes. Still can't find the remotes for the Apple TV. So I've been using my phone and my iPad for that. I'm not going to tell anybody where listeners where I live in case any of them are burglars. but yeah, it's quite nice, and I have Wednesdays off, which is, you know, why I kind of make sure that I get some podcasting done on Wednesdays. But it's nice, yeah. My legs don't hurt anymore. When I first moved in, the listeners, I probably told the listeners enough about this for them to know all this, but this is the part of the podcast we like to call "What's Going On with Alex's Life." Kat and I used to live in a one-bedroom flat next to a pub. The only stairs we had to deal with were the ones going up to the from the front door up to the first landing, and then everything was just on one floor. And then we've moved into this three-story place. We've gone from this one-bedroom flat to a four-bedroom, three-story townhouse. And seriously, I swear to God, my legs hurt so much for the first month after I moved in. Going up down the stairs all the time. It's just agonizing.
Really? Really? Okay.
Yeah, no, really, seriously, because if you get into the habit of not using stairs very often, then, you know, and suddenly you go from having to very rarely use the stairs to going up and down like two flights if you want to go and get something.
How did they go? How did stairs go?
They go up and down.
Up and down, that's it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Up and down. You know, you have to go up or down. Like, if I want to go, because, I mean, the other thing we've done is, you're probably thinking, you fool. The thing is, what we've done is we've put our living room on the first floor. So we've turned one of the bedrooms into the living room. And then what would have been the living room is the dining room. And then we have a spare bedroom across the hall from the living room. And then we've got an office and our bedroom upstairs. So we've converted two of the bedrooms into other things. But then it means if I want to go down and get something from the kitchen, then I have to go downstairs. If I want to go upstairs to get something, then obviously I have to go upstairs. So it's a bit redundant to explain that. But yeah, it was just, I think my body wasn't used to it for the first little while.
By the sounds of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds like you maybe need house servants, though.
Well,
would that be helpful?
No, I don't want to have to deal with them. I wouldn't be able to get around.
You don't want to have to deal with the lower classes.
Yeah, I don't want to have to deal with the riffraff. And also, I wouldn't be able to walk around with my tackle hanging out, would I?
Oh, Alex, really?
Which reminds me of that story you once told on Facebook of, I remember this because
it was a guy fixing a lamppost.
And you walked through, well, do you want to tell the beginning of the story? Then I'll say what I suggested you should have done.
I'm on the second floor and I walked into my living room. I think I was looking for some dry clothes, so I didn't have any on at the time. And it wasn't a lamppost. It was a telephone pole right outside the flat window. And there was a guy up his little ladder fixing it. And I walked in naked and it was like, oh, good morning. Hello. It's, I don't know who was more I can't remember being embarrassed, but what, do you know, Alex suggested that I perhaps take advantage of the situation to, you know, make a point, so to speak.
Yeah, I suggested that you should stare him straight in the eye and just start masturbating.
Yeah.
And see who cracked first.
At the time, I said to Alex, oh, good idea, I wish I'd thought of that. I didn't actually wish that I thought of that at the time.
Did you inwardly think, what the hell's wrong with you, Alex?
I thought, hey.
Block.
If that's what you would do, that's what you would do.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I don't think I would, but I'm one of these people
who takes all sorts.
Yeah, I like to suggest things to people. I see myself as an ideas man. You know, safe in my little castle, suggesting things to other people at the front line, letting them take the flack, and then me going, oh, did it work?
Do you miss Dundee, Alex?
I do miss Dundee. Do you miss Dundee, Lyle?
I do miss Dundee. I'm really fond of Dundee.
Yes.
And, it was when I moved to Dundee. I think we were both in the city at the same time for only about, it was maybe 6 months or something like that. I was going to come and help you move, I seem to remember, but I didn't. Before you moved to, did you go to Birmingham from there?
I went down to High Wycombe to start with.
Right.
And then split up with the girl I was with.
All right.
And then ended up back in Birmingham accidentally, with the intention of it being only temporary. That was 8 years ago, and I'm still here, and now I've bought a house. So the only, as is always the way, though, the only temporary part of our lives often comes into the that's where you are. But I really like Dundee. Dundee, and it's something that gets mentioned all the time on the podcast, you know, and if listeners don't like that, then go to Dundee and you'll find out why we like it.
It is, but I think it has to be said, though. I mean, it's, you know, I admit, it was a great time for me. I mean, it just, I hate to use the word scene, but there was definitely a lot going on there for the size of the place. And, you know, I've met so many great friends there and great people and great and talented people as well.
Yes.
And it was listening to, Fat Goth, the podcast the other week there. And, Fat Goth are by far my favorite band just now. I think they're the best band in Scotland by a long shot. And I consider myself friends with Fritz. I don't know Mark and Kevin that well. I don't think I even met Kevin when I was there, but he seems like a great guy. And Fritz is a great guy, like total sweetheart and really talented. Me and my friend Mike Lenny from there as well, we were always like, yeah, Fritz is going to be a millionaire someday because he's just like super good. And it's just like, you know, I don't speak to those guys, like a lot of the friends I made in Dundee, like they're on Facebook and stuff like that. And, you know, people move and just life happens and all the rest of it. You never seem to see people as much as you want and things like that. But it was just thinking about that while I was listening to the show, and it was just like, yeah, I do get nostalgic for Dundee. It was just, I don't know, a lot of great people there. And it was more than just the music that was going on. Like, it was more than just fantastic musicians, because you had people who are amazing artists, really great graphic designers. And you have people who are, you know, into writing and journalism as well. And I think I was thinking about what makes a scene, because it's a difficult thing to think about. And if people don't know what I mean by scene, you know, a kind of collection of people in a city where similar things are going on musically and, you know, in other artistic avenues. And you really need more than just the music. You need people who are really gifted artists and graphic designers and writers and the whole lot going on. And that's the kind of fondness that I've got for Dundee. And that's not over romanticized either. I mean, it was actually, and there's still great stuff going on there as well. It's, definitely. Dundee will always have a really, really special place in my heart.
I think the thing that made the Dundee scene, at the time was that not only were there kind of a lot of kind of very good bands, and I've said it before, and I actually recorded a podcast, last week that's going to be coming out fairly shortly with Gord. And we talked about this on that podcast, and we talked about the fact that there's, I think it was, where was I going with this? Yeah, it was that there was a lot of very talented people in the city, and more, that was it. What I was going to say was that he and I were both of the opinion that there were more good bands per head of population in Dundee than anywhere else in Scotland.
Yeah,
and because Dundee, as I've said before, very fairly small population. A fairly small physical city. Mm. You know, I've lived in bigger towns. But it kind of sits for the. For the listeners that aren't aware of it sits on the north side of the River Tay, and it has hills north of it, and over the river there's hills to the south, and then the North Sea is out to the east of it, and then you go off into you know, central Scotland, off to the west. But geographically where it is, it's actually quite sheltered, so it, you know, you do get cold weather, you do get wet weather there, but a much, much less than you get anywhere else in Scotland. It's actually one of the sunniest places in the UK that isn't in the south of England. And it has, my abiding memory of Dundee is that it's always had kind of fairly good weather. And it's very.
Yeah, it's nice and dry in Dundee. Yeah. Pavements are dry.
Yeah, and it's kind of very nicely walkable city as well. You can get everywhere pretty much on foot, or the buses or taxis that were never particularly expensive because you weren't going anywhere very far. But the thing about the scene there at the time was that not only were there these artists and musicians there, but I think the people who were doing music, everybody was quite opinionated about things. There was a lot of strong characters all at once.
Yeah.
But they weren't kind of fighting each other. I mean, there was a little bit of, you know, there'd be a little bit of kind of standard kind of intra-band rivalries.
Yeah.
And occasionally, you know, you'd have fallings out with people and, you know, getting to rouse with people, which is absolutely natural in that kind of thing. And possibly made worse in a city that is that small, where you'd always see the same people at gigs and stuff. But
yeah,
I think that there were so many kind of opinionated, I don't want to use the word extrovert because I don't think there were people that were extroverts necessarily. I think there were people who had the confidence to present their work.
Yeah, you basically you needed to have you know, you needed to have as much contrast as a pantomime does, the kind of figures, for it to be memorable, I think. And I think that's what it had. It gives it a lot more of a stronger identity, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. I think you're absolutely right there. And I think it was. And the thing is, it kind of, in fact, the Scottish music scene as a whole at that time, it benefited a lot from the Jock Rock message board run by Stuart McHugh, which both you and I were regular denizens of.
Yeah, the Jock Rock days. I don't know, those were good days. I'm fond about those days as well.
I think the thing is, it's one of the first, I think it's the first time I encountered you was on Jock Rock.
Yeah, it would have been, yeah.
I remember thinking, here's a guy who's very sarcastic and very funny and has a good sense of humour and has a dark sense of humour that most of the other posters aren't picking up on.
Yeah, and I think I understood that while you're kind of like, criticisms and opinions of music were probably true to your own taste. I got the kind of character that you played quite a lot on the board as well.
I'm so glad that you picked up on that.
Yeah, because I think most people didn't. And it became like a sort of joke to me. Once I got that, then it just became hilarious to read anything that you'd written about other bands.
You see, the thing is that what I was trying to portray was a kind of almost Chris Morris-esque thing,
yeah,
of this completely over the top, obviously a joke kind of.
Yeah.
You know, I was so extreme with things. I kind of, you know, I'd think of Chris Morris on the day to day talking to that woman about the Jam Festival, and her saying, "Oh well, you know, we've got these celebrities." Like, well, what celebrities? And they're saying, "Well, we've got Sebastian Cohen." He's like, "I hate Sebastian Cohen."
Yeah,
and that kind of thing was always in my mind when I was thinking. I kind of thought people are going to have to. They're obviously going to get this. They're obviously going to get that it's a joke, but nobody did.
No, they didn't.
And then I'd push it further because I think, okay, well, I'm going to see how far I can push this. And it resulted in a lot of people thinking I was the world's biggest arsehole.
Oh, you were hated. You were properly hated by some people. Seriously. Did you ever, like, you know, meet people at gigs or something like that and almost get into fights or anything? I mean,
the only people who ever kind of got into an almost fight with me were Degrassi.
Oh, a bunch of crybabies, Degrassi. Yeah, I played a gig with them. It was in Kirkcaldy in Fife, and it was in this god-awful little divey pub, and they'd brought their gear, you know, and they had, like, big proper Marshall amps, and the guy wouldn't let me use his amp, you know. Now, when you play gigs, okay, for anybody who doesn't know, it's pretty common. I mean, drummers get really kind of like, they're like, oh, I don't want you using my snare, because, you know, you're hitting it and stuff, and they're like, I don't want that to get broken by somebody who doesn't know what they're doing, so... With drummers, it's fair enough. But for a guitarist to say, oh, I don't let other people use my amp in case they break it. And you just think, how on earth am I going to break your amp by playing it, you idiot? And it was like, are you trying to make yourselves look better? Because we all look pretty shit just now. It's raining in Kirkcaldy and Fife in this shitty outskirt little pub. We're all looking pretty terrible, mate. Like, you know. But they wouldn't let me use their amp. I had to use this little crappy backup thing. And from then on, it was shortly after that, actually, that you... I think you said something about them being a bunch of crybabies, and I was like, I know exactly what you mean. They are like that.
Yeah, what led it to it for me, and it led to an almost decade-long vendetta they had against me, was that they had their gear stolen, which is an awful thing to happen.
Oh, right.
And I think that, and I wouldn't recommend that for anybody. I'd recommend it. What a weird thing to say. I wouldn't wish that on anybody, because it can be absolutely shit. But they posted on Jock Rock saying, some kind of stolen our gear. Does anybody know who did it? Like like you would. And I, in my Jock Rock persona, just replied, it was probably music lovers. That was enough.
Right, okay.
That was enough to send them into a very, very long vendetta against me, which culminated in, I went along to review them at the reading rooms for Is This Music? And they kind of confronted me. And then when I was leaving, they came outside and, well, I think what they were trying to do was throw a bottle of beer at me, but they missed so badly that it just went sailing off in a different direction.
Right.
So
that's funny. That could have been dangerous.
Well, I always describe it as, you know, they hated me so much that they actually came outside and spilt their beer at me. Mm-hmm. Like, in my general direction. It's like, yeah, but that's, you know, that's what happened with them. And I kind of, I remember telling them to get over themselves to their faces and saying, look, guys, really just get over yourselves. It's not a big deal. You know, and it's, you know, but yeah, there was occasionally instances where I'd run into people that hated me. But the thing is, once people got the joke, or once they met me in person, they actually suddenly went, oh, actually, he's quite reasonable and
Yeah.
Quite a nice guy. But I think for a long time...
I agree that happens. And also, I think people also maybe feel a bit stupid in that moment because it all suddenly dawns on them what's been going on and they're like, I didn't get that. And, you know, they realise it was completely unnecessary for them to carry that animosity.
Well, the thing is, I still kind of do it a little bit.
Good.
There's still an element of that.
Good.
Still...
Didn't you say you were winding up some young bands from Birmingham?
Oh, my God, yeah, on Twitter. Yeah, yeah. I started.
Well, what's the scene like down where you are? Is there anything going on that people should know about?
It's very fragmented.
Right.
It's very difficult to get shows down here unless you know the right people. There is a local music magazine called Brum Notes, which which follows on from the rich legacy of other Brum-related puns. When there was Brum Beat was the magazine that was there in the 80s and 90s. But Brum Notes is, you know, it's there. They're doing it. There's another magazine called Area, which is a bit more kind of arts and theatre and everything else. Thing. So, I mean, for the second city, it has got its own press, and there's quite a lot of bands, but a lot of them are what I would describe as boring guitar bands.
Right, okay. What kind of style, though? Are they kind of just, if you know, bland, schmindy indie guitar bands?
It's a bit like that, yeah.
Right, okay.
But, you know, the ones that are still trying to, you know, rewrite all the songs you've ever heard and thinking they're being super original doing it.
Right. I know what you mean.
There's nothing, I would say, amongst those bands that makes them stand out.
Okay.
They're just dull. Dull, grey, beige, you know, porridge bands.
Yeah.
And it's... but I think that's the same everywhere. I think there's always that kind of level of bands that sort of sit there like this bland filler in a sandwich.
Yeah.
So
they become offensive by being inoffensive. That's a frustration with that kind of sound.
Yeah, and they also kind of swag around as if they're the greatest things ever.
Yeah, I've seen that plenty of times.
Yeah, and they kind of just keep going forever, and some of them are still going, like, you know, like you said before, 10 years later are still...
Oh, it's tragic. It's tragic.
Yeah, and so so that's what it's a bit like, and it's... I've always found it difficult to get people to come to shows here, and I found it difficult to get shows here, and I think that's another thing I miss about Dundee, that it was always so easy to get gigs.
Yeah, I've read a couple of posts, you seem to get pretty down about, you know, trying to get gigs.
Yeah,
But you said it was quite difficult in dealing with people. Do you find that people are just not very good at getting back to you, or are they demanding too much, like you've got to sell tickets and all that nonsense?
Well, I'm not very pushy when it comes to things. I don't like having to deal with promoters, and I never have liked dealing with promoters. I find dealing with promoters quite stressful, which is why in Dundee I always put gigs on myself. I just used to be the promoter. And I kind of always look at places and think that'd be quite an interesting place to play a show. And I kind of, as I'm getting older, I kind of look at places like coffee shops or like libraries and, you know, places that are maybe not... I've gone past the point of wanting to play in stinky pubs, basically.
Yeah.
The thought of going into a pub and playing with drinkers there and all stuff, you know... it just doesn't appeal to me at all.
Well, when you've done it enough times, it's just, you know, you really got to keep it fresh for yourself. That's what I was talking about earlier, you know, because, you know, like some gigs can be good, you know, you can either like meet a new band, for example, that are really good, or it just for some bizarre reason, it's quite a large crowd who are really into it, or you just get to see your pals. I mean, that's a good enough ambition of going out, you know, and playing a gig, but it becomes tedious for me.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, I've moved to a new place. I'm just 2 minutes down the road driving from Wolverhampton. Bilston itself is a small town, kind of, you know, it's a small kind of, one of these weird kind of, has been absorbed into the larger conurbation kind of towns. But it has its own town centre and its own identity and stuff. And there's a couple of places that look like they could be quite good. There's a little cafe just down the road that looks like it's got a function room and does do things and has got quite a good reputation from what I've read about it. And I kind of start thinking, well, you know, are there enough people in the area? If I started putting things on, would people come to it? You know, I only need to get like 15, 20 people to come along for it to be worthwhile.
Yeah.
Or do I kind of try to work out another way of doing it? Or, you know, I mean, this year it's been, I've made a lot less music this year than I have any other year. I've been quite kind of low key with the music.
You've only made the 20 albums this year?
Yeah. Well, I mean, last year it was over 50 releases I did last year.
Good grief.
Which is crazy.
Good grief.
But this year it's only been 3, I think.
Right.
It's just been the stuff I've been doing under the name of Small Glass Ghost. which I kind of started using because it was 10 years since that album of the same title had come out, the second The Moths album.
Yeah.
And it seemed to be about the right time to do it. And then I kind of was asked to do something for a little net label. That the idea was that you just use samples of other Creative Commons derivatives allowed music. So I kind of decided I was going to make this very kind of sparse beats only thing, which is like maybe 20 minutes and little 10 little short tracks of just like little kind of rhythms, like these almost like little miniatures of just sketches of drum parts.
Right.
I quite enjoyed doing that, and then kind of went on and did more of that, made an album of that called Home's Gone Forever, which was kind of a tribute to Butterburn Court in Dundee, where I used to live, which was demolished this year. So the cover of it actually has a photograph of that and the building next to it, Bucklemaker.
Oh, right.
And so, yeah, Home's Gone Forever was... I was quite pleased with the way I titled it, because the first one, the first track is kind of almost the same as the album title. And I'm just going to look it up, because I need to make sure I get it right. Because the comma's just in a different place. So the album's called Homes, comma, Gone Forever. And then the first track is called Home's Gone, comma, Forever.
Yeah, I quite like that.
And I thought, yeah, that's actually good. So, yeah, okay, yeah, the first album, the first little EP was called Fake Beats, which was these little just beats made up of out of the people samples. Then there's the Home's Gone Forever thing. Then there's something I did when I was playing around with working out how to perform it. And I recorded it in live because, you know, I could record the output from it. And I kind of thought, actually, that's quite good. So I put that up. And then I did something for a tape label. So I did 2 15-minute kind of ambient things, and nothing ever happened with them. So I eventually just put it up myself. So actually 4 releases this year. But yes, that's been quite low key for me. But then,
it is, yeah.
But then I have done, you know, 20 odd episodes of this podcast, and quite a lot of the other podcasts, which has now gone video, so people know what I look like. So see my mug on things. So yeah, so you know, it's. I don't know. I think it's been one of those years where making music hasn't been a major priority. But I'm sure, I'm sure you find the same thing. You know, you go through periods of not having anything to say musically.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, basically what I've found with the albums that I do is there's normally a couple of tracks that are quite old ideas. It could be like, say, an old guitar riff or a completed song, and then I write new lyrics for it. But it can be, you know, a good 10, maybe 15 years old, you know, one or two tracks that I'll throw in amongst brand new stuff. Because I normally find that, you know, if I've got an idea, it doesn't matter if it's really old, if I think it's a good idea, I'm like, well, maybe I can rework that and, you know, bring it in. And I quite like to make albums 10 songs long. It's just a nice figure that I go for. So if I've not got quite enough material, I'll go back to, you know, a catalogue of riffs or songs, you know, from a few years ago.
But the stuff you've been making over the years, I mean, there was a brief period when you were using the name Caveat Audience, wasn't
it? Yeah, that was the start, because I wasn't sure about how to... That was not long after after I'd come out of playing in a more live band, and I thought, well, how do you do this? Do you just kind of... Is it all right just to, you know, use your own name, or would that come across as sort of like really egotistical? Because it's a bit, you don't really know how to do it, and you think, well, do you want your actual name to be kind of branded in some way? And it's, you're not sure what to do. Yeah. But then I kind of realized, like, if you just, so I thought, well, just go for something a bit more obscure, and what all you really want to do here is write and record some music and just put it out, and if you like it, great. And if not, then it's not going to hurt you, because you're not so insecure anymore and you've kind of matured a bit. But then I thought, it's just a bit more personal. Just put a face and a name behind it. You don't have to kind of hide behind if people aren't quite up to their Latin, Caveat Audience, man, it means listener beware.
I really
like it. I don't know. I liked it at the time, but I thought just put your name to it. Just get, you know, just, I don't know. Yes, so I was using that, but then I just put my name to it, and so it's just me, Lyle Christine.
And the thing is, I mean, I'm actually looking at my Lyle Christine kind of collection on my on iTunes here, and it is 7 albums, 70 songs, so 10 songs per record. And yeah. I really, you know, I think there's that still that kind of,
is it seven albums?
Yeah, I've got Why Does My Album Stand?
I did a covers album. Is that including that?
Oh, is it? I don't know. Uncanny Valley.
Uncanny Valley, yeah. That was a covers album.
So I've got Why Doesn't My Album Sound As Loud As Everyone Else's, which I thought was a great title for a record.
Yeah.
The thing is that what I really liked, there's always these kind of sly digs at the music industry in it.
And yeah,
this kind of almost kind of weird disgust with the whole process of doing it at all, kind of baked in, it seems.
That's exactly what I struggle with, basically, because it's... I think it was kind of a conversation that you had with, I've forgotten his name, the guy from Leto.
Fraser?
Fraser, yeah. Fraser from Leto. I never met him, either, but, it was basically, it was along the lines of, you know, you're kind of, when you make music or you have any kind of artistic temperament, you really are driven to do it. And it's difficult to talk about that without sounding really pretentious, like I must create. Mm-hmm. It's more like you are driven, you're compelled to do it. It doesn't matter in what form and to what level of success you're eventually aligning yourself with. You're compelled, you know, you're basically compelled to do it. And it's, I suppose the philosophical question is, why am I doing this? I hate the music industry, and yet I've approached it before, I've worked with it before. And ultimately, you know, you are, when you distribute your music, say online, you are presenting yourself in a way that's supposed to be appealing in a certain consumer fashion. I mean, you could disseminate your music in a variety of ways. You could be extremely obscure about it if you wanted to, but then you think, well, you are still putting music out there to be listened to by an audience, and it would be nice to have an audience, ultimately, end of the day. So, but the actual kind of like mechanics of business and industry, and especially things like working with promoters or being let down by people who run venues and all the rest of it, it is a disgusting process. And then you've got your mainstream, what I still refer to as mainstream, everything that's been going on for like the last 10 years, not just your obvious stuff to do with, like X Factor and Pop Idol and stuff like that. I don't really care about any of that kind of stuff. It's more the actual music that's been made by quite well-known bands. I just think it's been a really bankrupt period for anything interesting. Could be just getting older. I don't know. I don't think it is that, because I still consider myself to be a reflexive and critical person, regardless of whichever historical location I happen to be, walking through. I just think it's been terrible. I don't know why. I really don't know why. What's been going on? I don't think my tastes have changed anyway.
Well, I mean, I think.
What do you think? Do you share something similar? Take from about the year 2000. Now, you had that horrible time for guitar music, especially when the Strokes came out. That was a massive moment where I just thought, what the hell is going on here? This is terrible. And that's because their music's rubbish, but the way they got the record deal and all the rest of it, and then there was a series of bands that were doing this dreadful kind of garagey rock thing, and then, I don't know, it just seems quite poor to me.
I think what happened from my perspective was that around that period, around the kind of early noughties, I kind of really stopped listening and paying attention to Radio 1 and stuff like that, and really kind of was getting more and more into kind of, it sounds terribly elitist, more kind of obscure material. And so I kind of managed to avoid all that, and I think I stopped reading the music press around that time as well. I think the only magazines I kept buying were, I think it was about that time I started buying The Wire. Just because I liked the fact that they'd have, like, on one page some 70-year-old guy who, you know, lives in a shack somewhere. And on the next page would have some kind of 14-year-old from Glasgow who makes insane drum and bass.
Yeah.
And I liked that. And the weird thing is I'm actually finding myself starting to find The Wire a little bit kind of stuffy now as well. It's like, oh, God, it's the same again. Oh, it's going to be there's an article about performance artist, yawn. And, you know, I'm starting to think, well, next time I renew my subscription, will I just go digital only? And then is that the way to slowly building up to kind of like just going no subscription at all? But I think that's what happened. I think I managed to avoid getting too irate about bands. I think the bands that offended me, though, were... Mm. What was that band that Pete Doherty was in?
Baby Shambles.
The one that was famous.
Oh, the Libertines.
The Libertines. Fuck me. They were horrid.
Yeah, they were, yeah.
And it was that era, seeing stuff like that, when it was all about, look how cool we are, we're the best.
Just fucking London bands, man.
Yeah.
Is there anything grosser? It just, yeah, I hated all that as well. And thankfully, it doesn't seem to exist anymore. But yeah, I don't know. It's it's something. It goes deeper than that. I don't know what it is. I think this maybe there is a responsibility of. I mean, I have an absolute hatred. I mean, a total contempt for the I was saying earlier, like the internet generation, the Generation Y. There seems to be people born circa 1984 onward, sort of thing. That generation, the hipsters, you know, this generation that just, I just can't fucking stand them. I honestly cannot fucking stand them. It's another disgust I have with humanity is that generation. And it's to do with this, you know, pastiche should be, there should be an intelligence and a wit to pastiche. It shouldn't be just a collection of things and false memories that you instantly become nostalgic for, and you try and pass that off as new culture. It's just a mess they've created, and yeah, I think that is perhaps a large problem.
It's like the Instagram effect, isn't it? It's, you know, yeah, people in the future are going to look back and think, why were all photos yellow in that era?
Yeah, yeah.
Was there exactly something wrong with their cameras? Was there some problem with the sun?
It's poor taste. It's just poor taste.
Yeah.
And that sounds elitist, and I don't mean it to. But I can't help but describe it in those kind of terms, though.
But I think part of it for me that kind of offends me about it is that it feels like they're co-opting my childhood. And they're co-opting my legitimate memories of things being like that.
Yeah, precisely.
Into kind of like this pastiched version of it. So, I mean, I have got photos that are genuinely yellowed because of their age.
Yeah.
From, you know, the 70s and 80s.
Mm.
You know, because I was born in 1972. So, you know, I've got, you know, it's a horrifying thought that my memories now stretch back 4 decades.
Mm.
But, you know, there's things from, you know, 35, 40 years ago that I've still got,
yeah,
that have got that kind of patina of age to them legitimately.
Sure.
And when
sure,
it's then kind of faked with software and, you know, to create this kind of visceral, but artificial nostalgia, yeah, I think I find that offensive. And I think the way that things get co-opted so quickly, I mean, it's like, the end of, Breaking Bad, I thought was a beautiful sequence. I really liked the use of the Badfinger track.
Shh, 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 shh.
I'm not going to tell you anything about it. I won't tell you the end.
I've come to Breaking Bad quite late. I've got the whole lot, and I'm working my way through it.
It
wasn't so long ago everyone was talking about the end of it. You can spoil it for a bit if you want.
I'm not going to spoil it for you. No,
okay.
It's a fantastic. The final episode is as good as you could hope. Basically,
right, excellent.
It's the only show, and we talked about this with Miles and Sanjeev last episode, or the last episode I put out, which is actually not the last episode, but anyway, it gets confusing. Yeah, I mean, it's a perfect ending, but they use a Badfinger track at the end. I'm kind of waiting for that to turn up in the X Factor this year, because it's in the same way as Don't Stop Believing, it got just co-opted by everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think it was used first in The Sopranos, and then Glee adopted it.
That's right, yeah.
Because it had been in The Sopranos, and then everybody adopted it because it had been in Glee, and it's just like, oh, for fuck's sake. So I'm waiting for this this Badfinger track to turn up in, you know.
I think you're right, it will happen.
Yeah, it's going to be TV Week or something on The X Factor.
Yeah.
The one with the straggliest hair will sing it.
Mm.
You know, and it's so predictable.
What do you think about the whole X Factor pop idol thing and all the rest of it? Are you offended by it? Do you have a strong opinion?
I am weirdly torn about it, Lyle, because I think the overall process is crap beyond words.
Yeah, of course it is.
The only part of it I enjoy, and this is why I feel like, and this is actually something that was talked about in the very first episode of this podcast over a year ago, the part that I enjoy is the bit when all the people who are shit are on it. The deluded shit people.
Yeah.
And I hate myself for liking that bit, because those people are going on there with a legitimate dream.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there going, look at that idiot.
Yeah.
That woman with no teeth and is obviously mentally ill is going to sing a Cher song. Oh, look at her. She's going, do you believe in love after love? And look, Simon's sniggering.
I think that's quite funny. I mean, you get some people who, you know, on one side who are like, I can't believe that it's the exploitation of the most vulnerable people in society. Yeah, it is, but so what? And they say, oh, well, it's, you know, that's got such a large role in the destruction of the music industry and there's no such thing as, you know, proper talent anymore and that sort of thing. And I don't think it's had as much impact on, you know, good music or the business model as everyone thinks. I just don't care about it that much. Just don't.
No. I mean, well, the thing is that's kind of disturbing is that, you know, if you tell people at your workplace that you can sing or that you do music, they go, are you going to go on Britain's Got Talent or The X Factor?
Oh, yeah, that bright enough, yeah.
And you're like, No, I'm not. Because I've got some fucking dignity.
Yeah, I suppose that is the frustration element. If that's what people think it means to, you know, make music, perform, sing, be in a band, they think that's what your automatic dreams are going to be, then yeah, that's frustrating, you know. Yeah.
And they just churn out kind of really dull people, and you know, each year you get people who are just exactly the same as the year before. Like, I was getting James Arthur mixed up with the one from the year before. I can't remember what his name was, the one before.
I don't know their names either. I just avoid it. It's one of these things. It's quite easy to avoid. It's kind of that weird thing when people get offended by something that's just so, it's just really easy to avoid. It's like thinking about, it's like with the kind of the atheist and religious debates and that sort of thing. And especially, you know, there's a lot of angry Muslims, and you can see these debates on YouTube very easily of just the smallest things that people can get offended by. And it's like, I find dog shit offensive.
Yeah.
Okay, I find dog shit offensive. For that reason, I don't spread it on my sandwiches. It's quite easy to avoid something that you don't like. And it's, you know, it's in America, you know, people being so absolutely offended by homosexuality, and I think, how is it, you know, how are you being offended by this on a daily basis unless you're creeping about looking into people's bedrooms or something? Like, it's so easy to avoid something that you're offended by that it makes you look very childish to, even if it's quite an important issue, it's still easy for you to just walk away from it and say, I don't want to be offended by this, so I'll walk away from it. But anyway.
I think the religious get upset about it because they think that the creator of the universe is upset about it.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, the creator of the universe, it always happens to be offended by exactly the same things as they're offended by.
Yeah, true.
Amazing that, isn't it? How their God happens to find exactly the same things offensive.
Yeah.
You know, whereas like, what I find offensive is, like James Arthur's old band, the James Arthur Band, still calling themselves the James Arthur Band, even though he's no longer a member.
Oh, right.
He's still riding his coattails.
Yeah. Oh, that's tragic.
Yeah, that's what happens. Yeah. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There's things that are more important to get offended by. I mean, I'm offended by the fact that children are starving in Africa, you know, and I'm offended that, by the fact that I just sounded like Bono, and I'm offended by, you know, and I'm offended by people not giving them money. Give them money! And I'm offended by the accent I just did. You know, there's so many things that are offensive all the time. And I think as you get older, you just find yourself kind of allowing yourself to laugh at the shit stuff and going, well, it's there anyway, and yeah, I could fight against it, and I could make the world better, but it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I don't know. It is. I think it has taken a much bigger picture of what's going on. I mean, there's a lot of things in the world to be angry about, but you know, it's X Factor and the kind of destruction of culture really one of them? Well, I mean, it just...
Yeah, it just means over the years, I've taken a more kind of Zen Stephen Fry-esque approach to it. Things change, and that's how it is.
Yeah, but I mean, when you're talking about, like, you know, so like, I'll use the term underground, because I still do think of things just in terms of mainstream and underground.
Yeah.
I don't think X Factor has made it any more difficult or any easier for underground bands to achieve what they want. I don't think it's actually affected anything in that respect whatsoever, but I've heard people in bands saying, you know, oh, it's become even more difficult to try and work with people who are associated with record labels or promoters and all the rest of it. I just don't think that's true at all.
Well, I think bands that are saying that need to get a fucking grip, because why are they bothering working with these people?
Yeah.
Why do they do
exactly,
it?
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, if they want gigs, go and make gigs. I mean, I think I was talking about this, again, it's coming up on a podcast that will be released fairly shortly, which I get kind of very kind of mixed up with the timescale. So from my perspective, why I am recording this, it is going to be released in the future. But from the point of view of the listeners, it was released and you've already heard it. So, but yeah, it's when I was talking to Gord, we talked about this, about how it seems, I think Scottish law allows you to have live music in venues up to a certain size without having to have a music license.
All right.
That's now spread to England as well. You've got, you know, you're allowed to have up to 200 people in a venue without having to get a music license. And for unamplified music, there's no upper limit. So you can have a choral thing with, you know, 10,000 people there watching. You don't need to pay for the license to have it on, which I think is a fantastic thing, which it means you can have house shows and stuff. Now, in the UK, we do tend to live on top of each other. So it's quite difficult to have house shows. But the option's there. So bands can do that. They can go and play, you know, find a friend who's got a house that's got a little bit of space around it, play a gig there, get your friends there, go and hire a room in a pub. Don't wait for the promoters. Just go and do it yourself. As far as record labels go, fuck them. Who cares? Put it out yourself. Bandcamp is a genius thing. I use it.
It's lovely, isn't it? I love Bandcamp.
You know, I've almost reached the point where if a band doesn't use Bandcamp, I think, what the fuck are you playing at? Why aren't you doing this? Because you just sit there. You don't have to do anything. You upload your tracks. And you just leave it. And the stuff's there all the time. And
it's great. They cracked it. They absolutely cracked it. Everything from the layout to, you know, the usability of it. It's just great. Because there was, for leading up to Bandcamp, there was a few websites offering certain things. But it's like one website offered one thing but was deficient here. And another website offered that but was deficient in something else. And then they finally brought it all together in Bandcamp. And I think it's great. I mean, I only heard of Bandcamp from other bands that I know using. And I was like, oh, well, I'll use this. And it's really lovely. It's a good website.
And the great thing about it from the point of view of the end user is that they can download the format how they want. They can go for an uncompressed AIFF file or whatever.
Freedom of choice is the essence of life.
You know, if they want to use a FLAC file, they can get that. Or they can go down to super compressed 64, you know, kbps, MP3s, you know. They've got the choice at the end. I mean, I use a site called Rootnote to get my stuff onto Spotify and Amazon and iTunes. But I don't make any money from there at all. Actually, I tell a lie, I've made about $1 in the last 2 years off it.
Right.
Which I have.
Isn't it quite expensive to get your stuff on there? It's like 50 quid or something, I heard, to
Rootnote's
get onto.
It's free, which is why I use it.
So with, what's it called? Rootnote?
It's called Rootnote. Yeah, but root Nothing. As in like how to get somewhere rather
Rootnote.
It's fantastic. Go and play with it. The interface is horrible. It's really clunky. It's a pain in the ass to use, but once you've got everything uploaded, it's great. Occasionally I go on there and just chuck stuff up. And it gets, and you just tick a box to say which outlets you want it on. So eMusic, the whole lot, all of them.
Very good. Okay.
But I now see that as a promo thing so that people can stumble across it, maybe then Google me and find my Bandcamp page.
Yeah.
Because I make more money from Bandcamp, and I make virtually no money from Bandcamp, but I make more money from that than I ever did from, you know, iTunes or whatever with the Moth stuff that's up there.
Yeah.
And I've never made anything from Spotify because, you know, two plays by myself don't really count for much. But, yeah, I mean, I think Bandcamp's great. I think the fact that you can just sit there and occasionally get an email saying somebody's bought your record, you've got, you know, some money. And you're like, I don't even have to post anything out. Genius.
It is. That is a luxury, definitely.
It's fantastic. And part of it, I kind of did get angsty about the whole idea of physical formats dying, but I've kind of got over that now. I think it's actually all right that things are digital because it sounds the same to me. The music's the same. So why should it matter that it's not on a piece of plastic that's wasting resources?
You know? Yeah, and I don't think I ever really had a massive problem with that. I mean, the only thing, ultimately, when it comes to vinyl, I do think music sounds better on vinyl. It's not convenient to, you know, organize your own output around vinyl at the end of the day. So, I don't mind that. I prefer just keeping everything digital. That's fine.
Yeah. And it means I can walk around with a box in my pocket that's, you know, smaller than a packet of cigarettes that's got, you know, at the moment, something like 11, 12, 13,000 tracks on it, something like
that. Yes, ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah. And then I just leave it playing, and then I tend to listen to my radio. So, you know, it just sits. The weird thing I tend to do with my iPod, and there's a trick I found. It's something I can recommend to all iPod users. Even if you're not using it, take it to work with you. Hit shuffle and hit play, and just let it play all day, every day. And the reason I say that is because that will stop the hard drive getting all kind of seized up. And they actually seem to benefit from being run pretty much all the time. Because I've got an old fifth generation one that my parents now use. And I did the same with that, and it just got used all the time. And it's still perfectly happy. The battery's fine as well, because the battery gets run down regularly. So the charge cycle stays, you know, fresh and all this kind of stuff. It's a little insider tip.
It's a good top tip, Alex.
And then you can do what I do. You can then use iScrobbler to upload it all, and it makes you look like you've listened to all your cool music when you've actually just been sitting there with it, just no headphones plugged into it, sitting on your desk. It makes me look like I'm a music lover, when actually just I hate music.
Sneaky.
That's a little inside trick. So anybody who goes to look at my Last FM page and sees my, you know, amount of plays, I've listened to probably about 10% of what's actually scrobbled. So, mind you, that's actually, it's probably less bad than that, because there are days where I just sit with my music on all day in my headphones. But recently I've been listening to, I found that time goes faster at work if I'm listening to kind of podcasts of things. So I've been listening to, actually, the one I would recommend as well, I've been listening to the Richard Herring Leicester Square Theatre podcasts, which are fantastic, where he interviews other comedians and people like that, and it's brilliant. And Richard Herring's very, sounds very good. Funny. Yeah.
Yes, he is. Yeah, I'll check that out.
Yeah. So he's actually playing in Wolverhampton soon, and I'm going to see Stuart Lee on Saturday. Yeah, just remember that.
Great. Comment, was it you who put up that link of, was it a Telegraph reporter who walked out of a Stuart Lee gig recently?
I've heard about that, yeah. Kat was telling me about it, that the guy had written a review that was really slagged him off.
Yeah, kind of, but it seemed like his pal, his journalist pal, who perhaps, you know, works at the same place, something happened that he took more offence with Stuart Lee with, and so this guy decided to write a piece saying, oh, I walked out of a Stuart Lee gig, that's how cool I am, sort of thing. But it wasn't actually him who had a problem. It was because, you know, Stuart Lee's part of his thing is a bit kind of slagging off the audience, especially if they're not kind of like participating or something like that. But this guy was taking that attitude of like, you know, if I pay to see somebody, I don't expect such toxic abuse. And, you know, it's just like, oh, Christ's sake. I mean, it seemed quite ridiculous.
But it comes back to the whole thing we were talking about before. It's the persona. And Stuart,
yeah, well, there you go.
Yeah, he said that the stage version of him is an exaggerated version of the actual person.
Yeah.
You know, the public persona of Stuart Lee, the comedian, is of he presents himself as a bitter failed stand-up.
Yeah.
You know, that he's bitter that he's not successful, and he's bitter that other people are more successful than him. The truth of the matter is he's actually a very successful stand-up. He's respected by critics and audiences alike, but his persona is that of somebody who thinks his audience is beneath him, you know, has to spoon feed them everything because they're such retards, and it's but it's all an act. And I was listening to this thing with Richard Herring, and he had Russell Howard on, and Stuart Lee very famously did a whole lengthy thing about Russell Howard being kind of personally responsible for the death of orphans and starving children in Africa, because he doesn't do as much charity work as he could do. He was like saying, you know, he'd worked out that Stuart Lee, Russell Howard had done this charity bike ride for 3 days and had raised sort of this huge amount of money. And then he'd worked out if Russell Howard did bike rides all the time, he could raise X amount per year. You know, if he just didn't do anything but charity bike rides. And he kind of then does this whole bit with this little kid sort of like coughing in Africa, and his dad saying, no, don't try to speak, you know, it just hurts. And he's like saying, am I going to die? He goes, why am I going to die, daddy? And he's like, you know, because Russell Howard hates you. You know, because Russell Howard doesn't care. He just has to go and mock the week instead. And laugh at Susan Boyle's hairy face. Yeah. And Stuart Lee bumped into Russell Howard. And Russell Howard's quite upset about it.
Oh, what?
And Russell Howard was saying to him, well, you know, what was that about? And Stuart Lee said to him, that it's not me.
Yeah.
It's Stuart Lee, the comedian. It's not me that actually says it. And he kind of has this kind of strange, kind of almost split personality thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's all on the...
It's a shame when people don't get that, basically.
Yeah. But it's like, Yeah, and I think it's funny to play with personas, as both you and I have discovered, because, I mean, it's something that both of us do.
Like I said earlier, it's a pantomime. It's you know, and it's again, it's one of the areas that you can retain some personal amusement in, which is very important.
Yeah. It's just sometimes it doesn't translate very well, like at a workplace or stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, I'm convinced people where I work think I'm an arsehole because I kind of have that slight edge of it all the time at work. and it's, yeah, it kind of creeps in. But anyway, there you go. So we should probably draw things kind of neatly to a close shortly.
How do we do that? How do we do it neatly?
Well, I will tell you. I will guide you into the final straight line.
Okay.
Obviously, we haven't talked very much about your music, but we have kind of talked about it a little bit. But
I mean, it's kind of difficult. It's actually quite difficult to talk about music, except to say that we've mentioned some albums here, for example. So recently I had to, why did I have to do this? I can't remember, but I've changed my main website address. It was lylechristine.co.uk. Now it's .com.
Ooh,
so, and as we've said, everything's up on Bandcamp and everything's quite easily searchable and easily found. So if anybody's interested, please please pop along there and you can see for yourself. Currently recording another album. It's going to be another album, you know, that'll sit alongside these ones that are already there. Current shape of it, probably a couple of very acoustic-y tracks. It's not a bit of an eye-rolling, oh, here's the acoustic album sort of thing. It's not quite like that. And because I've just recently gone to Ableton, I'm very much toying with the idea of kind of contrasting a couple of lovely acoustic songs with some really heavy kind of like Beastie Boys type slamming hard beat tracks. Let's, you know, that sort of thing. I'll see how it goes, but that's going on just now. I don't know when that'll be finished. There's no title for it, but I'm pretty sure it'll be 10 songs long. And yeah, that's pretty much the way I can sum up the music thing just now. Isn't that pretty much how it always goes when, you know, people on these podcast shows start to talk about their music?
Yeah, well, it's difficult to talk about your music, I think. It's always really hard. It's like the awful question when people at work say, "What kind of music are you into?"
What do you say? How do you answer that?
I say, "I'm into music that you would never understand, peon." I just go, stuff, you know. Like that. There's no point even trying to explain. If I try to say, yeah, I listen to a lot of stuff by my friends and by this band that does this, and there's this band from like the early noughties that did this double album about the second coming of Jesus being in Texas. That's the kind of stuff I listen to because people's eyes glaze over. And, you know, and if listeners are interested, the album I was talking about there was the Texas Jerusalem Crossroads by Lift to Experience, which is a fantastic album. But anyway,
my ears just glazed over there.
So yeah, it's really difficult. But yeah, what I will say about your music is listeners who are unaware of Lyle's music, you should go and listen to it because he is a tremendous songwriter. His music is clever, it's funny, it's thought-provoking, it's often, well, I'm saying often, always brilliantly recorded. Whenever it comes up on my headphones, it sounds tremendously professional all the time. And I think, you know, from the purely technical side of the way you record, you're obviously doing something very, very right because it sounds amazing all the time.
Well, thank you.
I'm always really impressed with the way your records sound.
I do think it out. The actual production and the way it's recorded, I've got a massive interest in it. I find it a really enjoyable part of making music and producing music. So it's very, very nice of you to notice that. And there is a lot of thought that goes into it.
And it's very evident that there is because they sound fantastic, your records. Mm-hmm. You know, they're all good. The titles are fantastic. You know, I've always liked Dutch Carnage as a title was always,
and
Eternal Return of the Lame, that's a good one as well.
Yeah.
In fact, they've all got good names. There's always something slightly kind of, you know, knowing, and there's that sense of kind of slight disgust with the music, and she oozes through it all in a kind of, not kind of, a kind of love-hate thing.
I think so. There's a bit of contempt that comes out, and, you know, but it's not, I don't think it comes across in the spirit of misery. I think it comes in the spirit of, you know, what else can I say except this about things?
Yeah.
But I think overall, and again, it's a difficult thing to say without sounding a bit arrogant, but there's a bit of an intelligence that comes through, basically, and that's something that comes from investing a bit more time into lyrics. I don't know if you remember, Alex, but when I played in the band Stigma, you actually reviewed the first CD that we ever did. It was a 6-track EP.
Yeah.
And you put the review up on Jockrock. This was before we actually really knew each other. And there was a clangor of a track in there lyric wise. It was really, really bad. I don't actually want to have to repeat it, but it was along the lines of, "There's a little boy on the stairs, he's got tears in his eyes." Something like that. And yeah, at the time, I didn't really care about lyrics. I honestly didn't care about lyrics, and I thought, I've got to sort this out. So that's been a massive kind of, like, conscious amount of time practicing, you know, lyrics. What do you say in lyrics? How do you say something in lyrics? And I think they've eventually gotten to a point where it's pretty good. But it used to be fucking terrible.
But they are excellent.
Do you remember that review? Do you remember doing that? Do you remember the track that I'm talking about?
I vaguely remembered it when you started singing it that
Jesus
bit.
Jesus.
I don't remember
Christ.
What I said in the review. I'm guessing it wasn't particularly complimentary.
No, it wasn't. But it was honest, and it was actually spot on as well. That's one thing. There's not many things that over, you know, upwards of 10 years of making music that I totally cringe about. That's one of them. That song, and then realizing what I'd done, and then the review from you, and that's toe curling cringe. That's just, have you got anything like that? Anything that one moment you think back and you think that was awful? What was I thinking?
Oh man, there's so many of them.
Really? Are there though?
There's moments where I kind of think, it's not so much kind of the musical stuff, because I kind of have this very kind of, yeah, it is what it is attitude towards the music side of things.
All right, okay.
I kind of chuck stuff out and then forget about it, basically.
There's
things where I kind of more look back at the way I behave towards people. Yeah, that was a bit shit.
Yeah.
You know, I was a bit horrible to that person. Maybe I shouldn't have been quite as horrible, or maybe I shouldn't have text message broke up with that girl or stuff like that. You know, there's things like that you kind of think, yeah, that wasn't very nice. But musically, I tend to be kind of like, well, it's out. There's no point in worrying about it. But
best attitude to have.
Yeah, but I think there's certain things where there's been moments when I found myself thinking, I'm not sure what I'm doing with this now, so I need to stop doing it, you know.
Oh, well. Yeah.
I think that's possible.
That's very wise.
Yeah, well, it's like, that's why my Magnetic North Pole broke up, was I just got so fed up of doing it, and Maps of Jupiter broke up because we did a short tour and I realised I hated them all. So you were saying it's larachristine.com is where your website
is.
Bandcamp, I'm guessing, is larachristinebandcamp.com.
Yes, that's one.
Yeah. Do you tweet?
I don't actually. I mean, I do have a Twitter account. It's more just because I follow other people. I don't actually use Twitter that much. I don't know if I have. It's a bit of a, you know, I don't know how to get enough people to follow me to bother saying anything. But then if I'm not saying anything, then who the hell's going
to
follow me?
That's it. You have to just say things until people start picking up.
Yeah, maybe I'll start. So here's the first tweet. I'm going to start using Twitter. Okay.
Excellent. Fantastic. So yeah, just search for him and you'll find his Twitter again somewhere.
Yes.
So the new album's coming up. I would say definitely go and listen to them. If there's any track you'd like me to play out in the podcast when it's all put together, is there any particular one that's a favourite that you think people should hear?
Go for the first one of Grand Mal, Scaramouche.
Okay, that's the one I'll play out then. So that's what listeners will be hearing in a moment. They'll be hearing Scaramouche by Larachristine from Grand Mal. And Lyle, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you.
Alex, it's been great speaking to you, really great. And thank you for your kind words.
You're very welcome. What I'll do is I'll do a quick explanation, which I should have done before I started the podcast, is that in a moment I'll say goodbye, but then I won't kind of go, if you see what I mean. So anyway, so all that's left now is thank you for listening, everybody. There'll be another one at some point very soon. The speed I'm making these, it's going to be, you know, whenever. That's all I can say about that. Just a sound. All that's left is a Future Library goodbye. Goodbye, bye, bye.
special feature. Ignore fame's audit praise, challenge the teacher. Your portrait hangs in shame beneath the pedestal. A scale of 1 to 10 filled by a decimal. The choice was limited, no cash conversion. Dispense with discipline, nothing is certain. A stunning victory, gentle migration. Support the industry. The deal is raw, I need an extra clause. Security in case the bank withdraws. For many years I had a hand to hold, an exercise in how to gain control. A toast, a burning tribute, a conscientious host, a winning attribute. Forgive the entourage, nameless infection. Your scented sweet corsage, now in collection. A welcomed overflow of conversation. Exchange the altitude. The deal is raw, I need an extra clause. Security in case the bank withdraws. I had a hand to hold, an exercise in how to gain control.
Future Library is brought to you by petpiranha.com, where you can go and find out various things about people who we've talked about and various people who haven't been on the podcast yet, but might be in the future. If you want to follow us on Twitter, it's twitter.com/futurelibrary1, so that's Future Library with a number 1. And you can email me at alexbottom@gmail.com. And don't forget to subscribe via iTunes. Just search for Future Library there. That's it. Thanks.